Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. I'm going to talk tonight about the early 1950s in America, the Korean War, and the climate that the Korean War creates domestically in America, particularly surrounding the rupture in the relationship between General Douglas MacArthur and President Harry Truman. The nature of Cold War politics and domestic American politics had begun to radically transform the American political landscape from the end of the Second World War onwards, particularly in 1946, when the Republican Party decided that the easiest way to win back power, or to at least erode the democratic ascendancy which had survived from 1932 up until 1945-46, was not to waste any time attacking the economics of the New Deal. Though the Republicans despised that, because trying to convince Americans that the level of state intervention that had defeated the Great Depression and won a world war was somehow ineffective, given the radical improvement in living standards that had been seen within a kind of a decade and a half. This was not a vote winner. There was no meaningful offer that the Republicans could make. The core of Republican economic thinking had not really changed since Hoover, but this was the sort of stuff that one could not express. Roosevelt had successfully seen off all meaningful challenges to the New Deal. Some of the alphabet agencies had been proved unconstitutional at the Supreme Court, but the core ideas of a shift away from laissez-faire economics had prevailed. The Republicans had been defeated on that one. Their British counterparts, the Conservative Party, in 1945, had been forced to accept a much more mixed economy than they had wanted, and in 1947 they signed this thing, the Industrial Charter, where they agreed that Labour's gains of nationalisation and union rights, union power, and a large welfare state, that these things weren't going away. So the situation is slightly different in America. The Republicans realised that attacking the Democrats on the basis of their supposed softness on communism was the best attack line. Most Americans after the Second World War want to pay as little interest in the affairs of the world as possible and not to get involved in any international conflagrations. But by 1947, Truman, conscious of the possibility of the fall of Greece to the communists and the possibility even of the fall of Turkey and therefore a communist encroachment into the Middle East, recognises that the British are no longer capable financially of supporting either country, and it's going to be America's going to have to step in. So a kind of a robust anti-communist foreign policy that's not really in tune with what much of the American public want, but will help to fend off accusations of being weak on communism, combined with federal loyalty boards, the kind of the forerunners to the House and American Activities Committee and the heights of McCarthyism. These all have to be Democrat sort of innovations. And the crisis over in Korea, Korea is a Democrat war fought by a rabidly Republican general. MacArthur, who had all sorts of run-ins with Roosevelt in the war that would have seen a less high-profile general dismissed on the spot, is made commander-in-chief of the United Nations forces in Korea, and is only dismissed when he essentially challenges the decision-making of Truman over the threat of World War III against China. Now, tonight I'm reading from David Coates' brilliant book, The Great Fear. We've dipped into this before. It's well worth it. It's quite a venerable title. It goes back quite a few decades, but it's well worth a read. Okay, so he writes, a number of senators and representatives call for varying degrees of atomic warfare in Korea. The myth flourished that General MacArthur had been forced to fight with his hands tied. MacArthur's most attractive quality for Republicans and isolationists was his apparent desire to crush the communists with Chiang's army or with the atomic bomb. When Truman dismissed him in April 1951, a Gallup poll showed 69% support for the general with 29% support for the president. Truman had never been a particularly popular US president. By the end of 1952, when more than a million men had been drafted and almost 25,000 killed, the search for a scapegoat or a domestic fifth column became the stock in trade of the Republicans. A Knox County, Ohio farmer's wife put it this way about Truman: with our boys dying in Korea, he won't kick out the people who are fighting us. It makes me sick. So, long before Trump, long before Bush Jr., long before Nixon even, the ability of the Republican right to create really fabrications, myths, fantasies, folk devils for ordinary voters to get behind, to feel worried by, panicked by, and to look at the Democrats and the sort of a tranche of centre-left liberal intellectual life and elitism as being un-American, unpatriotic, dangerous and subversive. But there's an irony here. Truman was far more ready to commit American resources to the struggle against communism. In practical terms, in terms of willingness to commit funds and material and even fighting men to the containing of Soviet power, Truman's Democrats put far more energy and effort and time into this than their Republican critics. By the end of 1952, for example, the administration was carrying between 33 and 50% of France's financial burden in the Indochinese War. The Roosevelt interest in decolonisation and the end to European empires had been quietly abandoned by Truman. The officials in Truman's administration and Truman's cabinet looked upon anti-colonial movements as being essentially communist, or certainly questionable whether they would ever be allies of the United States, to ever be trusted. These were potential Soviet satellites. David Coate writes, in 1947 and 1948, a Republican Congress had rejected Truman's proposal for peacetime military training. The Chicago Tribune even opposed America's intervention in Korea. On December 20th, 1950, ex-president Herbert Hoover, a critic of intervention in 1941 and of the Soviet alliance, called for withdrawal of all American troops from Europe and Asia. Fortress America could rely on air and naval power to protect her. The Republican isolationists talked tough but shrank from the fight. After the truce in Korea, Senator William E. Jenner of Indiana demanded that America re-establish an anti-communist government in China and unify Korea to the Yalu River. How? By arming Japan and Germany and then applying diplomatic pressure on the Russians. If the Russians were not amenable, then expel them from the UN. And if the UN went to vote against America, then withdraw from the UN, said Jenner. We want no American forces sent to Southeast Asia. We want no carefully contrived emergencies by which we shall be forced to consent in haste to sending troops to Vietnam or Thailand. There is no way to defend the industrial heart of Europe unless we use those two great wells of tough anti-communist manpower, Western Germany and Spain. And this is said by Joe McCarthy, of whom we'll turn to in a moment. He clarified and in some ways expressed some degree of support for the Truman Doctrine itself, but from a more isolationist, let the others do the fighting stance. And he said, now I do not propose to send American troops into China or Poland, but I do propose that we give the anti-communist forces in those countries necessary aid when the opportunity presents itself. In some ways, what McCarthy was saying was rather similar to Roosevelt's arsenals of democracy position in 1940, that America shouldn't get involved in wars against fascism, but should arm those countries to the hilt that are the fighting front line. Ultimately, what has been America's trajectory in the post-war era has been that it has had to commit the fighting men too. So Joseph McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin, elected in 1947, built his career on the foundations that Truman had kind of created for him. Truman's capitulation to the Republicans, his desire not to be seen soft on communism, on this rather imaginary spectre of communism that existed in America, and his desire to radically tack to the right, didn't take away the anti-communist landscape, the anti-communist kind of ecosystem that the Republicans thrived on. It added to it. It created opportunities for people like McCarthy. Now this is like the Overton window of discourse had been shifted to the anti-communist right. Things that had not particularly concerned many Americans or not particularly occurred to many Americans before, suddenly became a constant drumbeat of ideas and scare stories. And David Coate writes, McCarthy's voting record was quite typical of his parties. In 1950 and 51, he voted against the four-point programme to aid underdeveloped countries, and he also voted for cuts in foreign military aid, which is, contradictory to what he'd previously said. Not a coherent thinker, necessarily. He opposed a budget increase for the Voice of America, the radio. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. claimed in May 1952 that such isolationists were cheered in the Kremlin while they fought a sham battle at home to cover their stealthy desertion.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Allies abroad. This sham battle was known as the 20 Years of Treason, to quote a phrase made famous by McCarthy at a Lincoln Day dinner. The hard fact is that those who wear the label Democrat wear it with the stain of an historic betrayal. He denounced Dean Acheson, who he called the Great Red Dean, and his Crimson Crowd, who betrayed American boys dying in Korea. He castigated the Acheson Hiss, referring to Alger Hiss, Latin War group, and dragged up the fact that in November 1945, Dean Acheson had shared a platform with Paul Robeson, the famous left-wing socialist African-American actor and singer and intellectual, Corliss Lamont, and Joseph E. Davis, who was the former ambassador to Moscow, who was always kind of tainted with the suggestion, he was one of Roosevelt's ambassadors to Moscow, that he was far too comfortable with Stalin. At Madison Square Garden, this took place, and it was a meeting sponsored by the National Council for American-Soviet Friendship. Well, a lot of what McCarthy would churn out would be sort of circumstantial stuff. This idea that there had been some kind of 20 years of betrayal since Roosevelt had entered the White House, and this had led to somehow American boys dying in Korea, and that the Democrats had been deliberately, purposefully soft on communism, had allowed the communists to seize power in Korea, just as supposedly they'd allowed the communists to seize power in China. A lot of this was based in the what were known as the Venona decrypts. These were this was intelligence signals traffic that was intercepted by the Americans and the British, that showed that there had indeed been people within Roosevelt's administration who had passed information to the Soviets. The key one being Harry Dexter White. And the inference here is that there were Soviet spies working in Roosevelt's administration. It's entirely possible that this is indeed true, but it's also entirely possible that Roosevelt needed back channels, needed people leaking information, passing information, and communicating with the Soviets, and perhaps he was even aware of some of it. However, the fact that it was the picture emerged that there were indeed some sources that either spies or people passing information to the Soviets had virtually no bearing on almost anything that that McCarthy was saying. The idea that there were people in Roosevelt and Truman's administrations desperate for the communists to win in the Korean War is, of course, patently absurd. But this shows you the extent to which the Republican Party would use whatever they found lying around in order to throw at the Democrats. There's a certain kind of nihilistic enthusiasm for strife and for kind of for destruction, really. McCarthy went on to say, before Russia was recognised by the US in 1933, Dean Acheson was paid by the Soviet Union to act as Stalin's lawyer in this country. Alger Hiss, who was later accused of treason, Alger Hiss's brother Donald worked in Acheson's law firm. Had not Acheson refused to turn his back on Hiss, had he not been responsible in 1946 for granting $90 million loan to communist Poland. So it's all this kind of circumstantial stuff. But if you say enough circumstantial stuff to Republican grassroots meetings across America, it sort of sticks. I mean, you know, it is like the kind of the QAnon of the 1940s. One only needs to look at the kind of the tenuous connections that right-wing American TV show hosts on things like Fox News and sort of various insane radio shows tend to make in order to sort of create this kind of peculiar picture of the world. But you can make peculiar pictures of the world and people will listen to them and find them compelling. It's sort of very much in the telling of the tale, I suppose. So the McCarthy thesis, which was basically the kind of the Republican position and was repeated by other Republicans consistently when they saw how successful McCarthy was being, was that the communists within America had been more responsible for the success of communism overseas than Soviet Russia had. So if you wanted to explain why Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Albania, Yugoslavia, and then in 1949 China had all gone communist, it wasn't the Red Army, it wasn't Stalin, it wasn't Comintern, it wasn't Mao. It was traitors in the State Department, and it was traitors in at all levels of government. That's what was happening. And for Americans who the events in the wider world, as is very common, not just specific to America, were fast-paced and confusing and alarming and troubling, a simple explanation of treachery, like the sort of the stab in the back, the Dolchstoss, that people like Ludendorff came out with at the end of World War One. This is a lot easier to kind of get your head round. Traitors have done this. After we've fought to free half the world, traitors have wound up creating a much more dangerous world for America to exist in. None of this is that much of an issue until, of course, the Soviet Union in 1949 acquire a nuclear weapon, and then it's much more alarming. The biggest scalps that McCarthy would claim would be Dean Acheson and George C. Marshall, who'd been obviously the chief of staff during the war, was later the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defence, and who had been the architect of the Marshall Plan. Much of what McCarthy had to say was a kind of selective cherry-picking of the events of the Second World War. So, I quote David Coate here. Marshall, said McCarthy, had called for a second front in 1942, precisely as Moscow had done, implying that he was at the beck and call of the Soviets, which isn't true at all. It was just that both Roosevelt and Stalin had the view that a cross-channel invasion from Britain to France and a direct clash, a direct assault on Nazism there, was the way to go, was the thing to do. And Churchill probably wisely persuaded them not to do it. At Tehran, he had made common cause with Stalin, and again at Yalta, with Hiss at his elbow. He had induced FDR to bring Russia into the war against Japan, signing thereby the death warrant of Chiang's China. Again, a very selective view. When we had David Dean Barrett on the podcast last year, one of the points that he made out was that the numbers of Japanese soldiers still under arms in the summer of 1945 was immense, and that that Roosevelt knew that he needed Soviet manpower at Yalta. You know, obviously Roosevelt was dead by then, but in February 1945 at the Yalta conference, Roosevelt knew he needed Soviet manpower in order to defeat the Japanese. There was no, it was not clear that it would be, the atomic bomb would be there in time, and the Japanese initially, after the first bomb, were in fact nowhere close to surrendering. It's the second bomb that does it. So there are all sorts of reasons for Allied cooperation during the war, and there are, you know, the Soviet Union was obviously not necessarily a particularly attractive regime for America to be involved with. But if you look at the regimes that America has been allied with throughout the 20th century, human rights and civil liberties and the freedom of speech and freedom from arrest and persecution have never really been much of an issue. The whole point, and here's how the kind of the conspiracy theory works, the whole point was to put secret communists in positions of power domestically in America, and to allow, so it was alleged, communists to prevail overseas. He said, "What do we find in the summer of 1951? The Ritz of Moscow run to a good 40% of all men living. This must be the product of a great conspiracy, a conspiracy on a scale so immense as to dwarf any previous such venture in the history of man." Dismissal of MacArthur was explained in basically the same way. It was alleged that a secret inner cabal had conspired to get rid of MacArthur, whereas the reality was that MacArthur had challenged the authority of the president, and a general that can challenge the authority of the president and get away with it is essentially a dictator in waiting, a kind of a Julius Caesar, if you will. But this was kind of supposedly the work of Moscow itself. And the only choice, of course, would be an impeachment of the president to find out who is the secret invisible government. This is the kind of the level of rhetoric that's being talked about. Now, it's interesting that we talk about this now, on the eve of the second Trump impeachment, where you have characters such as Marjorie Taylor Greene and people like that in government talking about conspiracy theories which make the McCarthy stuff look relatively sane. There is a clear kind of precedent of conspiracy theory thinking and the weaponization of conspiracy theories in order to serve distinct political ends, and in order to place the Republican Party back on in a position of power. So what we see in America with Trump now is really nothing new. Anyway, let's finish there. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do remember to swing by our Facebook group, say hi. There's always some cool and useful content in there. And check out the new website, explaininghistory.org, where you can see all the videos I do. There's some new stuff going on the YouTube channel at the moment. And if you can sponsor us on Patreon, that's always great too. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.